This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 89-year-old Clay Comer of Fresno, California. He served with the 83rd Infantry Division during World War II. And in April of 1945, while chasing retreating German forces across Europe, Mr. Comer experienced a few hours that he would never be able to erase from his memory. He and his fellow soldiers came across the Langensteins-Weberger concentration camp, where in the final year of World War II, the Nazi regime had sent nearly 7,000 prisoners into forced labor. Many were of Jewish origin. There were also non-Jews of 17 different nationalities, and they were there in brutal, starving conditions, forced to dig an underground tunnel where the Germans could construct jet aircraft and V-2 rockets. I know you weren't there for very long, Mr. Comer, but what did you see?
We saw pretty much skin and bones and just walking corpses, really. They were just on the verge of not making it another 6 months at the most. They were fed just enough and given enough liquid to keep them alive. But beyond that, they were walking, I hate to use the term, but they were walking dead. And they were so grateful when they were released from these prison camps that the Allies, the Americans, had freed them, and that they were going to finally be liberated from their terrible conditions that the Germans had caused them to have.
Yeah, and as I understand it, this was one of those camps that was a forced labor camp, where not only they're being starved and pretty much tortured, they're being forced to work like 16 hours in a day. So you saw a lot of gratitude on their faces, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's correct. And even though that we could see that they were rejoicing to be freed and that knowing that we were the ones who liberated them and they had no longer reason to fear, and yet we couldn't stay there and enjoy that and celebrate with them because we had to keep on moving because we were still pursuing the enemy. And this was just overrun a camp. Now, we probably didn't spend more than 2 or 3 hours realizing who these people were. And I'm sure that our rear echelon type of took care of the needs that they had as best they could with what they had to give them to make sure that they saved them from perishing and any further than I'm sure that many of them had in the camp. It was a time that you just don't have time to really realize what you have just liberated and what you've seen. You're too busy going and doing whatever your job was. As a foot soldier, you just do whatever you're told to do, and you do it as best you can.
I'm guessing then, and again, that's just a leap of my brain trying to put the pieces together. I imagine after the war, when you're back home and the Nuremberg trials are happening and all this, then you're probably putting two and two together and said, hey, I saw some of that.
Well, I did see the Nuremberg trials after the war was over, and we were in what is known as occupation. So one of the things that we were offered in occupation, and by the way, we're occupying a German prison camp, and I was a bread ration sergeant assigned that anyway to figure out how much bread all these prisoners, the Germans, were to get.
Let's straighten this out for people, because before, the camp you were just talking about where you saw the walking corpses, those were prisoners of the Germans. Now you're talking about after America has won the war and you're part of the occupation force on an American-run camp holding Germans as prisoners.
Yeah, I'm glad you straightened that out, because I can see where that would be quite confusing had you not taken hold and straightened that out for me.
And you know what? Before we get there, I'm sorry for bouncing around. Even though you were only there for a few hours at this camp, was it a shock to your system? I mean, had you ever imagined that human beings could live in those kind of conditions?
No, it was a total shock. The only devastation that was ever worse than that was when you're advancing and you do pass over casualties of the enemy that were killed, and their still bodies are still there, and you're still advancing it and just passing them by. And I guess some of our people eventually take care of that. But as an infantryman, that's not part of your job. So you just keep moving. But to see these, as I referred to them earlier, I think, as walking corpses, it is very devastating to know that humans can be so inhumane, even in time of war. But that's the difference between a dictatorship under Hitler and our democracy of America. We never treated any prisoners like that. In fact, the people that we had that were prisoners from not only Germany, but Japan, and I'm sure a lot of Italian prisoners too were taken. And they were never treated like that because we were civilized Americans. And it is so disheartening to know that mankind can be so cruel to the fellow mankind. And it is not the men in the army or there in their army. It is what we call unavoidably and mistakenly leaders. Trust me, anybody that would advocate treating people like they did, and they're not leaders, they're destroyers of mankind. And it's going on today throughout a lot of the world, parts of the world. It's horrible to know that I live in a world that we still have to kill somebody and blow them up, all this kind of stuff. It just doesn't make sense to this old man. I can't conceive that our leaders can't be leaders instead of destroyers. And they should know by example of what happened in World War II, as well as some other wars, that it doesn't pay to be other than a good leader, someone who wants to better their country and the fellow man in their country. Instead of, even in recent years, we hear that leaders of their country are killing their own people. How insane can our society have become? It's just very disheartening to know that I've even lived in a time when this has happened. It should never have happened, and it's still happening.
Especially when you were part of a generation who fought to, in theory, to end that kind of thing. Tell me about the rest of the war for you. When was that moment where you realized, you know what, it's over. I don't have to fight anymore.
Yeah, we were holed up in the town across the river from Dusseldorf, which was a great big industrial city in Germany. And the town right across the river was called Neuss. I think it's pronounced Neuss. And I was up in a factory building, and we were still shelling across into Dusseldorf because it was one of the last cities in all of Germany to surrender and give up. We could even see the shells bursting in the factories over there in Dusseldorf. We got our times to lay down in the factory that I was in. I went up a stairway, and then it makes a landing, and it goes up another direction. And the landing is about 5 feet by 5 feet, and I thought, I can get some sleep here. So I laid down, and I took off my boots. No way could I go to sleep until I put my boots back on again, because it felt so unnatural to have the boots off. And so it was shortly after that, and it was while we were there held up in Neuss, that Germany did finally surrender completely, and the word got out that we were no longer at war with Germany. So that was a great time.
But you stayed there in the occupation force, and as you said, you worked in a camp where German prisoners were held. What were your interactions like with these defeated enemies?
Here again, we're dealing with people that are generally pretty sane. Germany had a great reputation for being an advanced society, as well as we. And so in the prison camp, you have people who are as knowledgeable, I hate to use the word intellectual, as you are. They were not combative. By this time, they realized, you know, they're prisoners. It doesn't pay to try to kill any more Americans, nor did it occur to us to mistreat any of the Germans. And there was one guy, I still recall, his name was Howie, H-O-W-I-E, I guess, Howie. And we would have arguments, and because so many of the foreign countries over there do speak English as a second language, unlike us who hardly ever learn a second language, they do over there. And so Howie and I would have some pretty good arguments about his way of life and his Der Führer. And so we'd actually have some wrestling matches, which I love to wrestle because I had pretty good strength for a guy my age. So it wasn't a bad time. It was just time, doing time, until such time that our governments could get things settled down to where we could get back home again.
And what was it like to get back home again? What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember getting back home. When I went overseas to join the 83rd Infantry, I went over on the Queen Elizabeth, which at the time was the largest ship afloat and a little bit larger even than the Queen Mary. A lot of people mistakenly said, well, the Queen Mary was the largest ship. Well, yeah, it was up until the Queen Elizabeth was built, and it was a little bit bigger. And we went over in four days and something to Glasgow, Scotland, where they docked. They couldn't dock at just any place because they were so big. And they never traveled in convoy. They always traveled alone, because in a convoy, you can only go as fast as the slowest ship. Well, the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth would both be at the bottom of the ocean had they had to go in a convoy instead of by themselves. Well, they were powerful enough that they could get up to some pretty good high knots and outrun most sub challenges. And of course, the word was out that we had been chased by a sub. And so when we landed in Glasgow, Scotland, and then transferred to a smaller boat to go to Le Havre, France, to eventually complete that joining up with the 83rd Infantry. But then coming back was a little bit different situation. We had to come back on, the ship I came back on was called Blue Ridge Victory. It was just a relatively small ship, and it took us a little over 10 days to make it from Bremerhaven to land in New York. That trip back of 10 days was a heck of a lot longer than that going over there in 5 days. I used to get up in the bow of the ship, right up in the very nose of the ship, where I could look over the railing and straight down where the hull was cutting the water, and I'm counting the yards as they went by, thinking I'm just that much closer to home. That was the first time I got choked up, a little emotional, thinking about that. Because that was all important to me to get back.
What was your reception like in Fresno when you got back home?
Well, it was wonderful. When I was discharged up at Camp Beale, which was just north of Sacramento, there was no direct transportation that I knew of to get back to Fresno. I think I rode a streetcar through Sacramento and out the south end of Sacramento on my way to Fresno. I caught a ride with a truck driver for a while and hitchhiking, and that's how desperate I guess I was. I couldn't wait till there was a train or a plane or anything, which I couldn't have afforded anyway. So I came home, and then when I called my parents, they came and picked me up, and of course they notified my girlfriend, which we're still married, 67, 68 years later, and Glennis and my parents came, and they saw me there. Oh, it was at the bus station, Greyhound bus, that's right. And I remember my mother got a little bit disturbed later on when she wasn't the first to give me a hug, but my little girlfriend, Glennis, ran ahead and greeted me and gave me a big hug. So it was wonderful to be back. And when I got back, unlike many of the stories that we hear nowadays, we got back home to the where I grew up, got in the closet, got my pants and shirt, civilians, and put them on, took off my uniform, and I still have the Ike jacket, even though I have just recently turned it over to a grandson.
But you still fit in it.
Yeah, I can still wear that Ike jacket, and I have pictures to prove it. I transitioned from a combat veteran to a civilian not even overnight, but from the time I got home till I took off my uniform and put on civilians and went back to living the life of a civilian. I didn't need any a shrink to tell me what I'm supposed to think or how I'm supposed to feel. Maybe I wasn't smart enough to get all upset, and that might be the answer. It pays to be ignorant, and in that case, I think I qualify.
Well, you mentioned Glennis. I want to hear that story, and that's where I was going to go next. I know we're almost out of time here, but so you met her before you went overseas. Was she sending you letters the whole time you're racing across Germany?
Very definitely. Yeah, you bet. Real quickly on Glennis, and I shouldn't be quickly with her because she's special. When I was still here before getting drafted, Hammerfield had started, and there were GIs all over the Camp Pinedale, and there were a number of different installations around. And the Rainbow Ballroom was the big place for soldiers and women to meet. And so I'm at the Rainbow Ballroom in my civvies. I hadn't yet been drafted. And everybody else there was from either Hammerfield or Camp Pinedale or somewhere here in Fresno in uniform. And I was the only guy in the civvies. But as a young man, I still had early gray hair. And nobody ever challenged me and said, "What's the matter with you, kid? Are you 4F? No, nobody ever challenged me. So I'm at the Rainbow, and I look up on this riser a couple steps up that circled around most of the Rainbow. And here's this pretty girl up there. And four or five or more men were circled around her at the bottom of the stairs. And I went over there, reached right through those guys and took her hand and said, "She's going with me." And I come to find out later on that she was only 15. And I was 18. And so when I found out how young she was, I told her, "Don't tell my friends how young you are." It was something that was important at that time. So she stayed faithful to me the whole time, as I to her. No intentions of ever getting married before getting back out of the military. So when I came back, it wasn't long after that we married and raised three great children. A son first, and then a year and 11 months later, we had a boy and a girl, twins, and all of them are just doing fine, and all of their children are excellent. Not anybody is ever disgraced us in any way. Great family, and Glennis has been a great role model for them. In fact, so much so to the point that in 1950, at Mother's Day, always they select someone for the city of the county of Fresno to represent the mothers. In 1950, Glennis was chosen Mother of the Year. So that's an honor that we've always honored. And I think you can see by that what a quality person she is. And she was half of my business when we run Courtesy Moving Service. After I got back into the moving business, I then opened up my own company called Courtesy Moving Service. And Glennis ran the inside proficiently, and I ran the outside in training the men and working the moving jobs. So it's been a marvelous, marvelous period of our life. All the way through, I have no complaints about anything.
Do you have any advice? Because I don't think I'm the only one listening that wouldn't mind being married for 67, 68 years.
Well, make darn sure that the person that you're going to marry is someone that you do truly love and that they do truly love you. Because I think too many marriages start just because it's a thing to do. Well, my daughter or my girlfriend over here, she got married. I want to get married too. It's a lot more than just that. You better damn well know what you're getting into. It's a lifetime commitment. And when you take the marriage vows, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, you better be prepared to honor those. And so many times now, people don't have that commitment that we were taught as young people. Whatever you say you're going to do, do it. Don't goof off. You have to be true to yourself. That is so important to a successful marriage. So thank you for asking.
Well, thanks for answering. And thank you for serving our country and for sharing some of those stories with us. If you at home want to see photos related to Mr. Comer's story and proof that he still does fit into that Eisenhower jacket he wore nearly 70 years ago, get on Facebook and punch in Hometown Heroes Radio. Thanks for spending this hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, telling you once more what you've heard before. Freedom is not free.